90.7 FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Balalaika's ringing out. Well, that's because it's time for Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and this is the news you're not supposed to know. I'd like to start with Norman Solomon, who put an article in Global Research. He's put articles all over the place in many publications and on the web for years, and you know what? He started off here at KBOO Portland. Well, I should say started off. I mean, he was here anyway 2 decades ago and in this slot. But Norman Solomon has written, news media should illuminate conflicts of interest, not embody them. But the owner of the Washington Post is now doing big business with the Central Intelligence Agency, while readers of the newspaper's CIA coverage are left in the dark. The Post's new owner, Jeff Bezos, is it Bezos or Bezos? I don't know. He is the founder and CEO of Amazon, which recently landed a $600 million contract with the CIA, but the Post articles about the CIA are not disclosing that the newspaper's sole owner is the main owner of the CIA business partner, Amazon. Even for a multi-billionaire like Bezos, a $600 million contract is a big deal. That's more than twice as much as Bezos paid to buy the Post 4 months ago. And there's likely to be plenty more where that CIA largesse came from. Amazon's offer wasn't the low bid, but it won the CIA contract anyway by offering advanced high-tech cloud infrastructure. Bezos personally and publicly touts Amazon Web Services, and it's evident that Amazon will be seeking more CIA contracts. Last month, Amazon issued a statement saying, "We look forward to a successful relationship with the CIA." Looks like they're already there, huh? And Norman Solomon also writes, as Amazon's majority owner and the Post's only owner, Bezos stands to gain a lot more if his newspaper does a lot less ruffling and more soothing of CIA feathers. Amazon has a bad history of currying favor with the U.S. government's national security establishment. The media watch group FAIR pointed out what happened after WikiLeaks published State Department cables, quoting, "WikiLeaks was booted from Amazon's web hosting service, AWS, so at the height of public interest in what WikiLeaks was publishing, readers were unable to access the WikiLeaks website," end quote. How's that for a commitment to the public's right to know? Much more on that article. Find it at globalresearch.ca, and it's an article by Norman Solomon. Well, as long as we're speaking of official spookery, the U.S. judge has indicted the NSA spying, and this article is from World Socialist, the WSWS.org. It's easy to remember, don't you think? WSWS.org. A ruling handed down by a United States District Court judge in Washington Monday found the massive spying operation which the National Security Agency sweeps up in stores in which the National Security Agency sweeps up and stores the records of virtually every phone call made to, from, or within the United States to be, quote, almost Orwellian, end quote. Now, I just got to stop right there. I agree with the United States District Court judge, except for the word almost. In Orwell's 1984, that telescreen was everywhere, watching your every move, and, you know, pretty much reading your every mail. But I don't see how it's almost. I'd say it's exactly Orwellian. But anyway, returning to the article, which, as I was saying, is in WSWS.org. While Judge Richard Leon's decision does nothing to curb the illegal and unconstitutional domestic spying by the NSA, this extraordinary description nonetheless stands as an acknowledgement, that the U.S. government is guilty of methods appropriate to a police state. Edward Snowden, the NSA contractor who exposed the existence of the NSA domestic spying dragnet, justifiably claimed the decision as a vindication of his decision to expose these secret operations to the American and world public. Quoting Snowden, I acted on my belief that the NSA's mass surveillance programs would not withstand a constitutional challenge, and that the American public deserved a chance to see these issues determined in open courts, that is. And that's the end of the quote. Well, actually, it's not the end of the quote. He also said, today, a secret program authorized by a secret court was, when exposed to the light of day, found to violate Americans' rights, end quote. And there's the end of the quote. In his ruling, Judge Leon, an appointee of former President George W. Bush, said that of the NSA's metadata surveillance program, quoting, I cannot imagine a more indiscriminate and arbitrary invasion than this systemic and high-tech collection and retention of personal data in virtually every citizen for purposes of querying and analyzing it without judicial approval, end quote. Now, speaking for myself, and not from this article at WSWS.org, this isn't just about collecting the information. It's about very intensely analyzing it, and I'll have more to say on that in a moment. But returning to the article, Judge Leon ridiculed the government's claim that a 1979 U.S. Supreme Court decision involving police acquisition of phone records of a robbery suspect over a two-day period could serve as a precedent legalizing wholesale spying on the American people more than three decades later. I think that's just a great sentence. That kind of brings it together with a snap, doesn't it? A robbery suspect. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that'll justify it. Well, anyway, returning to the article even more significantly, the judge rejected the core pretext invoked by the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it to justify not only unrestrained domestic spying, but every other attack on democratic rights at home and every act of militarist aggression abroad, the war on terror. Leon pointedly observed that the government failed to cite a single case in which analysis of the NSA's bulk metadata collection actually stopped an imminent, terrorist attack. He based his decision in part on the utter lack of evidence that a terrorist attack has ever been prevented by searching the NSA database. You can find much more on that article by going to WSWS.org. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell, bringing you the news you're not supposed to know. This is a counter-propaganda and left opinion program. And your comments and questions are welcome. Now I want to go to another, I would say, headline-making article. This is on Counterpunch, and it's by Chris Busby, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's most hated person. A new study of the effects of tiny quantities of radioactive fallout from Fukushima on the health of babies born in California, he writes, shows a significant excess of hypothyroidism caused by the radioactive contamination traveling 5,000 miles across the Pacific. The article will be published next week in the peer-reviewed journal Open Journal of Pediatrics. Congenital hypothyroidism is a rare but serious condition, normally affecting about one child in 2,000 and one that demands clinical intervention. The growth of children suffering from the condition is affected if they are left untreated. All babies born in California, and I'm departing from the article, this is the scope of the study. Oregon is not excluded. And I would say, talking about this phenomenon, if your baby was born here, Washington, California, this is all going to apply to you. Pay attention. Returning to the article, all babies born in California are monitored at birth for thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH levels in their blood, since high levels indicate hypothyroidism. Joe Mangano and Jeanette Sherman of the Radiation and Public Health Project in New York and Christopher Busby, guest researcher at Jacobs University Bremen, examined congenital hypothyroidism rates in newborns using data obtained from the state of California over the period of the Fukushima explosions. Their results are published in their paper, Changes in Confirmed Plus Borderline Cases of Congenital Hypothyroidism, I'm continuing with the title of the paper, in California as a Function of Environmental Fallout from the Fukushima Nuclear Meltdown. It's a scientific paper, so they get to have a long title. Returning to the article, the researchers compared data for babies exposed to radioactive iodine-131 and born between March 17th and December 31st, 2011, with unexposed babies born in 2011 before the exposures, plus those born in 2012. Confirmed cases of hypothyroidism, defined as those with TSH level greater than 29 units, increased by 21%. Yeah, I said 21%. That's 21% in the group of babies that were exposed to excess radioactive iodine in the womb. The same group of children had a 27% increase in borderline cases. Contrary to many reports, the explosion of the reactors and spent fuel pools at Fukushima produced levels of radioactive contamination which were comparable with the Chernobyl releases in 1986. Using estimates made by the Norwegian Air Laboratory, it is possible to estimate that more than, and some numbers follow, which I can't analyze, and so I won't repeat them on the air. You can find this article at counterpunch.org if you want the numbers. Talking about what was released at Fukushima. This is also predicted, he writes, by comparing the cesium-137 estimates with iodine-131 releases from Chernobyl, quantities which caused the thyroid cancer epidemic in Belarus, the Ukraine, and parts of the Russian Republic. More on this later. At Fukushima, the winds generally blew the radioactive iodine and other volatile radionuclides out to sea, out to the Pacific Ocean. The journey, 5,000 miles to the west coast of the USA, leaves a lot of time for dispersal and dilution. Nevertheless, small amounts of iodine-131 were measured in milk, causing widespread concern. The authorities downplayed any risk on the basis that the doses were very low, Busby writes. Far lower than the natural background radiation, the University of Berkeley measured I-131 in rainwater from the 18th to 28th of March 2011, after which levels fell. If we assume that mothers drank 1 liter of rainwater a day for this period, of course they didn't, the current radiation risk model of the International Commission of Radiological Protection calculates an absorbed dose to the adult thyroid of 23 microsieverts, less than 1/100th the annual background dose. The fetus is more sensitive by a factor of about 10, but is exposed to less as it is perhaps 100 times smaller. Now, departing from this article, just to point out, you don't drink a liter of rainwater every day, but you might have drunk milk in which the cesium and iodine was bioaccumulated by the cow. In other words, the rain fell on the grass, and hay, the cows ate the grass, and hay, this was, and ironically, this is more true in cattle that were allowed to free-range graze. So if you're concerned about your health, you might have had some of that milk and not known what was happening to you. It concentrates, but more on that. This is really all about bioconcentration. Chris Busby's article, as I was saying, in Counterpunch, presenting a portion of it for your perusal, returning to the article. So this finding is one more instance of the fact that the current radiation risk model employed by the governments of every nation is massively insecure for predicting harm from internal radionuclide exposures or explaining the clear observations. The Fukushima catastrophe has been dismissed as a potential cause of health effects even in Japan, let alone as far as California, and on what basis? Because the dose is too low. This is the mantra chanted by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the World Health Organization, and largely the same outfit, he writes, and the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. And let's not forget all the nuclear scientists who swooped down on Fukushima with their international conferences and placatory, soothing presentations. This chant was heard after Chernobyl. After the nuclear site, child leukemias, in the nuclear atmospheric test veterans cases, and in all the other clear situations in which any unbiased scientific arena would long ago have blown away the belief that low-level internal exposures are safe. But this one-size-fits-all concept of a dose is the nuclear industry's sinking ship. It provides essential cover for the use of uranium weapons, whether fission bombs or depleted uranium munitions, for the development of nuclear power stations like Hinkley Point, the burying of radioactive waste in landfills in Middle England, releases of plutonium to the Irish Sea from Sellafield, where it drifts ashore and causes increase in cancer on the coast of Wales and Ireland, and most recently for the British government's denial of excess cancers among nuclear test veterans. Busby writes, this new study is not the first to draw attention to the sensitivity of the unborn baby to internal fission products. In 2009, Busby writes, he used data supplied to him when he was a member of the UK government committee examining radiation risks from internal emitters to carry out a meta-analysis of infant leukemia rates in 5 counties in Europe, England, Wales, Germany, Greece, and Belarus. There had been an unexpected and statistically significant increase in infant leukemia age 0 to 1 in those children who were in the womb during the whole body monitored increased levels of cesium-137 from Chernobyl. The beauty of this study is that, like the TSH study, he writes, is that unlike the Sellafield child leukemias, there is really no possible alternative explanations. It was the low dose of cesium-137 that caused the leukemias, and the dose-response trend was not a straight line. The effect at the very low dose was greater than at the very high dose. And here's the sentence that hooked me. Chris Busby writing in counterpunch.org. The sentence that hooked me was, presumably because at the high doses, the babies perished in the womb and could not, therefore, develop leukemia. He writes, he published the results and drew attention to the failure of the ICRP model in the International Journal of Environmental and Public Health in 2009. Busby had published a paper on this infant leukemia, proof of the failure of the risk model in energy and environment in 2000, and had presented it in the same year at the World Health Organization conference in Kiev. It was there, he writes, that he first really came up against the inversion of science deployed by the chiefs of the IAEA and the UNSCEAR. The conference was video filmed, and you can see a documentary which made it to Swiss TV. It's called Atomic Lies, re-released in 2004 as Nuclear Controversies. You can find it on YouTube. It's 51 minutes long, Nuclear Controversies. If you want to pull that up and have a look at it. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Talking about Chris Busby's analysis of low-dose radiation from Fukushima and why this low-dose talk is bunk. He writes, for what is done by these people is to dismiss any evidence of increased rates of cancer or any other disease by shouting at it the doses were too low. In this way, reality is airbrushed away. What is this quantity dose? It is a simple physics-based quantity which represents the absorption of energy from radiation. 1 sievert of gamma radiation is 1 joule per kilogram of living tissue. This might work for external radiation, but it doesn't work for internal exposures to radioactive elements, which can produce huge effects on cellular DNA at low average doses. And here's another sentence that grabbed me. It's like, he writes, it's like comparing warming yourself in front of the fire with eating a hot coal. Or comparing a punch to a stabbing. Same dose, same energy, very different effects. He writes, this dose scam has been used to dismiss real effects since it was invented in 1952 to deal with the exposures from nuclear weapons development and testing. For those who want to dig deeper into the science, there's a recent book chapter Chris Busby wrote in the book New Research Directions in DNS Repair. He writes, the most scary instances of the sensitivity of the fetus to radiation are the sex ratio studies of Hagen Scherb, a German biostatistician and member of the European Committee on Radiation Risk. With his colleague, he has published a series of papers showing a sudden change in the sex ratio of newborns after various radiation exposure incidents. Sex ratio, the number of boys born to 1,000 girls, is a well-accepted indicator of genetic damage and perturbations of the normal ratio of 1,050 boys to 1,000 girls, and due to the deaths before the birth of radiation-damaged individuals of one sex or another, depending on whether the father or the mother was most exposed. And I just want to read that part again. The sex ratio difference due to the deaths before birth of radiation-damaged individuals of one sex or the other. And he writes, we found such an effect more girls in his study of Fallujah, Iraq, where there was exposure to uranium weapons, but Scherb and Voigt looked at the major catastrophes, Chernobyl, the weapons test fallout, near nuclear tests and data from many countries of the world, huge data sets. They estimate that millions have babies or had babies that have been killed by these subtle internal radiation exposures. Millions. The nuclear military project is responsible for a lot, an awful lot of deaths. In years to come, he writes, I believe this will eventually be seen as the greatest public health scandal in human history. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, talking about Christopher Busby discussing health effects of Fukushima and baby deaths. And Joe is on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say I kind of reminisce about the old days when there was a little bit of honesty in the local news, because back in 1987... about within a week or two of Chernobyl blowing its fuse over there and all that radiation drifting over this way, like Dr. Helen Caldicott said, it went up into the jet stream and circled the globe 6 times. But a lot of the strontium-90 that came from there was falling on cow pastures right here in good old Oregon, and it was landing on the, the story was about the farmers in the Tillamook County Creamery Association down on the Oregon coast, had to pull their cows indoors and keep them indoors for approximately 6 months. So the strontium 90 that was falling in the rainwater and stuff.
Strontium 90?
Yeah, it was strontium.
Not thorium?
Would dissipate, because I think they said the half-life of strontium 90 was 3 to 4 weeks. So they had to wait for it to decay far enough, you know, so it wouldn't be a problem. So they had to feed the cows stored alfalfa and hay and grains and stuff like that for damn near 6 months until it was safe enough for the bossy cows to go back outside into the cow pasture. But you would never hear that kind of a story nowadays. And by the way, I have called several of the so-called corporate news media, AM radio stations here and FM stations for that matter, and said, hey, why don't you do a daily rad report like one of the other FM stations here in Portland does? Actually, I didn't say FM, but I said, one of the other radio stations here in Portland does a daily radcast. And they said, radcast? What's that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's a reading of the what the counts per minute are. And I said, if I remember correctly, when I first was instructed how to use a Geiger counter back in 1978 on a hot summer day, the average counts per minute were 3 to 10 clicks per minute. And I said, now we're getting a low of 22 and highs of in the 50s and 60s here in the Portland area. And I said, we had one rainfall event where it was 198, which is damn near twice what the EPA alert level is at being 100 counts per minute. And all I got was silence, and they basically hung up on me. So I'd like to encourage all of the KBOO listeners to call the local news vultures, whether they're television or radio, and start asking them to run the daily radcast report, and I bet none of them have the gonads to do that. They're all too chicken.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up. I mean, that corroborates what I have found with my own counter over the last couple of years. And as I was trying to point out with the with Chris Busby's paper here, well, not paper, but his article on Counterpunch, the real danger here is not the fact that we're walking around with, you know, 22 counts per minute, 24 counts, whatever, hitting us from the outside. The real problem is that we have ingested this stuff. This is part of us now. And I find that when I measure bodies, I get higher than background. So we humans are bioaccumulating these doses, and it is having an effect
on us. Think about all that rainwater. I mean, we had one rainfall event. I can't remember if I heard about it on your show or one of the other news shows on KBOO. But we had one rainfall event here where the counts per minute were 198 right here in the Portland area.
And that's pretty scary, because the counts per minute, if you actually have your Geiger counter out, maybe if you're a musician, you're familiar with this, like 60 counts per minute would sound like this.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't be even, but it'd be like that.
Yeah.
120 would sound like this.
Yeah, oh yeah, no, it's
200.
And all that, you know, the Bull Run reservoir up there, I mean, all the not only the open reservoirs in the metro area here, but, I mean, the big ones that are up there on the foothills of Mount Hood, I mean, a lot of the rainwater that comes in from the Pacific Ocean scrubs off on those hills before it goes over the Cascades. That's why the east side of the Cascades is so dry, and so it all scrubs off on the western side of the mountains, and that's... I'd like to see what a reading is right up there at the right up there in the forest where the the lakes where these big reservoirs are, and just see what the clicks per minute there are.
Be worth checking out. Hey, thanks very much for your contribution to the show, Joe. Appreciate you calling in. Number call 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Been talking about the effects of internalizing radiation. And Tom is on the air.
Yes, good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Hey, talking about exposure, I'd like to do a little exposure of my own. You know, we like to think that there's a little political opposition to some of this nuclear madness in the United States. Well, I don't know if that there is. I think, you know, it's interesting to note that just a few years ago, Obama administration chief predator drone Hillary Clinton, acting in her other occupation as GE salesperson, brokered something like a $60 billion agreement for a nuclear power plant building in India. But of course, you know, we're worried about that because we're worried about Iran and their piddly little processing facility, right? Well, you know, we're so worried about nuclear energy that Obama administration a couple years ago also proposed a $40 billion $6 billion of federal loan guarantees. You read that handout to the nuclear power industry to build these nasty things here in the United States. And then to top it all off, they're pushing an aggressive strategy of militarizing space and building weapons platforms in space with the U.S. Space Command, in tandem with, guess what, with pushing the now right-wing government of Japan to renounce Article 9. You know, the country that was nuked by in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, now they're gonna be pushed to renounce Article 9, where the article that was put in the Interwar War II, where Japan renounces the use of offensive force and have an offensive military capability. And
yeah, so that's their mass psychological response to Fukushima is to suddenly become an aggressor nation again.
That's right. And so saber rattle against the Obama administration also wants to saber rattle in the area aggressively against China, which is also nuclear power. So, and by the way, one of the biggest contributors to Obama's rise and when he's a senator was Exelon Corporation headquarters in Illinois, which is the United States' largest operator of nuclear power plant. So these guys are soaking in heavy water.
Yeah, he's the latest face of the deep state.
You touched it anyway.
You know, the mask is interchangeable. Thank you very much for your call, Tom. Well, you know, it reminded me of something. I mean, just to talk about how little the generals care about what you think or whether they give you the truth or not. Many people are unaware, but these days we have the internet and you can find the corroboration yourself. Get a search engine and look up America's Secret Astronauts. Yeah, I'm not even kidding. This isn't UFO stuff. Back when we had all that talk, if you're my age, you remember all this. I was so proud that it was such a peaceful program to go to the moon. Well, that was bunk. Those same rockets were being used to launch a military orbiting space station, and not just one, I think. And those rockets, you can find pictures of them now, and they were going on all the time. It's kind of a creepy thought. And so take that information that you just heard, and consider this. And you hear that the U.S. is launching something. Something got launched at Vandenberg or some other location. Or I think they launched things in southern Oregon, too, out of the southwest Oregon. If those launch trails mean anything. The U.S. Has pledged in a treaty not to put up drop-down nuclear weapons. And it's talked about rods from God, iridium rods that can be shot down with terrific force and supposed accuracy on any target. Do you think they're really not doing that? Do you trust them not to? You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Now coming up, Parafogring is going to talk about Ukraine, and there will be much more of what we used to call the radio zine, so stay tuned to KBOO Portland.
KBOO supporters, we just sent you a card, so watch your mailbox. It's an opportunity to give a little more assistance at this time of year to your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Yep, tax time. That means that your donation makes a difference, and it'll really make a difference for KBOO because you can help us qualify for Oregon Cultural Trust matching funds. You can get more information about this on our website at kboo.fm/year-end-gift-2013. KBOO is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
Well, good morning. Show us Fight the Empire, and this is Per Fagrang. And my guest today is Professor Stephen Cohen, who is a professor emeritus at New York University and Princeton University. He has written books on Russia and many articles on Russia. And today we're going to talk about Ukraine. Professor Cohen, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Well, I was going through some old newspaper clippings in my files, and this kind of thing in Ukraine has been going on for quite a while.
That's because Ukraine, in some fundamental way, is not one country, but at least two. Some people think it's five, but that's too hard for me to think about.
Mm-hmm.
The eastern and southern geographic parts of the country are, in the fullest sense of the word, Russian. Ethnically, linguistically, religiously, culturally, politically, and economically. Those sections of the country are bound to Russian industry, to the Russian market. And by the way, in those areas of the country, there's a lot of intermarriage. I don't know the number, but I'd bet 50% of the nominal Ukrainian citizens of those parts of the country are married to Russians. The western part of Ukraine, which includes Kiev, the capital, historically has been closer to Poland, Sweden, and Lithuania. And it's interesting that in the recent protests in the streets and on the government level, where the European Union has pushed the Ukrainian government to sign an economic agreement with the European Union, the diplomatic or political leaders of the European Union have been the Lithuanians, the Poles, and the Swedes. So what you're seeing